This is GamesAtWork.biz with Michael Martin and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 264, Cancellations. Hello and welcome again to another edition of GamesAtWork.biz. This is one of two Michaels joining you today, whatever today is for you, to share news and stories and games and work and biz and all kinds of good stuff. I'm joined, as I always am, by my friend and co-host, Mr. Michael Rowe.
Hey, Michael. Hey, Michael. And this is the other Michael, as you are wont to notice, because of this natural, unstrained radio voice.
Yes. Well, you know, we may go between unstrained and strained on
totally
this show
strained
for sure.
This week's show.
it's been a week. It's been a week in the news on a lot of fronts. So we'll start things off with an example of, weren't we right? So the first article came across the Twitter feeds showcasing NASA's news that the pollution in China is clearing. And this is something we said, I think, 3 weeks ago when we were talking about air travel and comparing what is cooking or not cooking, as the case may be, in China, like what we saw for 9/11 with air travel being reduced pretty dramatically. And these NASA images of what pollution looked like in various spaces and places in China is a huge, huge difference one from another, aren't they, Michael?
Yeah, it's really cool, and it's interesting because I use a desktop background called Downlink, which provides about every 15-minute refreshes of satellite pictures of the Earth.
Uh-huh.
So you see cloud, but you don't see really pollution levels, right? But what this shows is, because of the large number of people who were not working during the government kind of saying, I know it's the holidays with New Year's, but because of the coronavirus, we're just going to lock people in place and keep them from traveling, and we're going to keep a lot of factories from working. The amount of air pollution was unbelievably lower to where it actually shows up on these images, to the point of just completely changing the sky and the pollution levels. It's amazing. It's amazing,
year,
I tell you.
They do a year-to-year view, so it's not comparing like a few days ago or earlier in 2020. It's comparing the same week in 2019, which kind of gives you a better flavor.
Yeah.
My suspicion is that with air travel also reducing due to a whole bunch of cancellations, and we'll get to that in a second, we will probably see something similar from that reduction in air travel on a global basis too. So super interesting. Let's do a plus one for Michael and Michael on a, we were right in predicting the interesting opportunity here of studying what are emissions related human activity and how that impacts what pollution is and where it is and how quickly it can kind of clear up too, because that's also the speed at which it's changed is also pretty dang dramatic.
Yeah. It would be interesting. Let's just pretend for a moment if we stopped all major pollutant manufacturing and air travel for, say, 20 years, what would happen?
Oh.
Breakdown of society as we know it?
Well, it'd be a lot different. It certainly would be a lot different. But you know, this is it's an interesting thought experiment when you consider changes that can be happening with local manufacturing, 3D printing. I mean, things we've been talking about for a long time, right, Michael? That as out there as your statement sounds at the on the surface, practical reality might well be that those are sort of benefits that we'll get to see more and more of, right?
Well, yeah, it will be interesting to see how this plays out. And, you know, as you say, we're going to talk about other cancellations. But one of the things I talked about last week I believe, was, you know, which things had we not heard about cancellations yet from, right?
Yep.
And what I like to do each year, if I can get it, is what I call my yearly education vacation. And the last 2 years, I've been lucky enough to be able to spend lots of money and go to WWDC by Apple, which is their Worldwide Developers Conference.
Right.
I was given the opportunity to give them lots of money and spend outrageous amount of monies for hotels and all this other crap. and I was really hoping and looking forward to it this year. And while we don't know if WWDC has been canceled yet, there's lots of rumors. And over the last couple of days, many more events have canceled or reformatted and refactored themselves into a, quote, digital experience. Jason Snell from SixColors.com recently wrote a really interesting article on Macworld, where he used to be editor-in-chief, talking about, you know, what it would do and what the implications would be, how would developers handle it. I mean, many people, most people obviously don't go to WWDC. It's about 6,000 people go each year.
Right.
But most developers in the Apple ecosystem are probably, you know, catching the keynotes online and then downloading or viewing online the individual sessions that meet their fancy, right? That talk about mm-hmm. the stuff that they're interested in, whether it's, you know, security, new AR kit updates, the changes to Swift, etc. But one aspect to think about is the impact that the individual conference has as an ecosystem event. And WWDC tends to have other little mini conferences that happen, quote, next door for all the people mm-hmm. who already booked their hotel and couldn't get in.
Right.
And you know, there's implications there. There's implications to, you know, last year, at my experience, the first day when they release all the code, I basically bricked my laptop.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
And if you ever want to go back and read my blog post about that, it was lots and lots of fun from last year. And, you know, had I done that at home, I would have been screwed. I mean, I literally had to get an Apple engineer with an SD drive to plug into my USB port and basically nuke the entire image of the machine. Just blow the whole machine completely away down to, quote, bare metal and put the factory install on, or what would have been the factory install of Beta 1.
Yeah.
And so the implications, the ability to have those one-on-one sessions with engineers goes away. Yes, you could do it via Slack or, you know, chat or whatever, but it's not the same thing. And while, you know, one of the foundations of this podcast was work that, you know, I did, gosh, 2008, so 12 years ago, around virtual environments and its implications for conferences, et cetera, the serendipitous interactions with other developers is still not quite there with digital events. And so the implications, if WWDC cancels this, it'll be interesting to see what they do to try to improve the underlying synergies that occur at these types of events. So take a look at his article. There's some good thoughts in there. And I highly hope that they don't. I really expect them to do.
Well, given that California is one of the states that have now officially declared a state of emergency as it relates to the virus and more, it to me, that becomes more and more likely. Obviously, I have no inside information on that, but I do have to smile, Michael, and say I'm glad you and I are on that same vector here, because that the level of serendipity is important. And some of Jason's comments in his article about, you know, just being able to interact directly with the people who are directly engaged in a particular feature or a segment of whatever kit or AR kit or whatever you're needing to work on, you can talk to them and learn who they are and engage with them is a that's a big thing.
Yeah, what they call the engineering, the engineering sessions, right? Where you literally, you know, you it's not even quite take a number, right? People line up, they open. I mean, there's like 100 plus people deep trying to get into these big doors that open. They open up and everybody runs to a table, and the tables are, you know, this is ARKit, that is Swift, this is Swift UI, this one's combined, right? Whatever the technology is. And it's like, okay, you're working on a new app that does this. Well, that's the engineer right there who worked on that API. Why don't you get 15 minutes with him? Or why don't you talk, you know, to that one over there? She developed the whole framework of combined. Why don't you spend a half hour with them? And you get that one-on-one time. You open up your laptop, you pull out your code, and you go, this is what I'm trying to do. That is the number one value that I got out of WWDC for the last 2 years. Number two would be meeting and talking with developers from around the globe, building up relationships. So when I have a problem, we actually have a couple of different Facebook groups that I belong to now with developers from WWDC that we kind of met in person and talked, where we fire questions to each other. Hey, I'm working on this. Oh, by the way, I've got this watch app. Take a look at this UI. What do you think? I mean, it's fantastic.
Yeah. And having that connection usually begins with an in-person sort of thing. So absolutely makes a ton of sense. Now, related to all this are how some other companies are trying to contribute to helping with the large amount of distance learning and distance education and distance remote work with one another. And there was an interesting article that came in a little earlier this week on The Verge about what Google and Microsoft are doing to provide enhanced Hangouts capabilities to all their G Suite and G Suite for Education customers, which will be, I think, an important thing for schools. And what Microsoft is doing with their capabilities around Teams to provide enhanced ability for people to collaborate and work from a remote perspective. So to me, the nice thing that we're seeing here in more and more spaces and places are tech companies that have capability along this line to provide at least an immediate stopgap help. At the same time, it is a try and buy exercise, right?
Oh, yeah.
So while it's free for now, this is a great opportunity for people to get a better, you know, experience in using tools like those, like Zoom, like Slack, like a whole variety of things to work remotely and be successful.
Well, you hit it just right. Try and buy, right? It's there is a little tiny bit of altruism there, but let's face it. If I can get you to see the value of my tools, and I mean, that's really comes down. Does it come down to the value? If the value is there, you see how, you know, your teams that are all currently kind of self-quarantined at home, or at least not coming into large groups in the office, are able to be, you know, as productive or more productive or as close to as productive, then that's a great sales pitch. I think it's genius. I think it's appropriate. I think it is financially responsible to give them away for now.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially, I think especially so for school systems. Google and the Google set of products are pretty heavily penetrated into school systems. So in Washington State, where many school systems are on a pause, you might say, and all of a sudden teachers who are used to having students directly there in the classroom are now shifting gears and having to deliver their classes in a distributed distance manner, the timing for this sort of thing is really quite powerful.
Yeah, the one thing I worry about with the school systems, at least in the U.S., this may be different in other countries, but the technological enablement of the students is widely disparate across different regions, locations, and locales.
Yeah, even in the U.S., that is an issue too. You're right. You're exactly right.
That's what I was talking about, from a U.S. perspective only. Yeah, I can't talk to other countries. And, I mean, if I just look across North Carolina, I mean, there are some cities where you have really good high-speed internet, The average family has that internet. The average student has, you know, at least a tablet, if not a home computer, right? So distant learning works well. But there are other cities and towns where the average person may have a cell phone, if you're lucky,
yeah,
with internet access. To total distance is conceptually okay. And you and I are both in the tech bubble. So we're like, oh, come on, it's easy. Just looking around me right now, I have, you know, the number of CPUs is insane.
Yeah.
But, you know, I know people that I interact with on a daily basis who their cell phone, while it is a quote smartphone, I wouldn't try to do anything on it other than read email.
Yeah, true. And I know school districts vary pretty dramatically. My kids are both provided with Chromebooks as part of their school experience. So they have at least that. And I've read where there is not a home internet access capability, there are hotspots being provided as well. So this is a challenge and a big one across the United States and I'm sure across the world, right? I can only imagine in Italy and elsewhere where they've got a couple weeks on us already on how to sort and figure some of these things out, what has to be done. It's going to be a big test of the infrastructure too, because if all of a sudden everyone is trying to do video classrooms and video conferencing and video, I can only imagine what the structure is going to be like for our telecommunications providers too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Be something else. So,
the big question is, we're talking about, you know, this implications, but how do you know if things have been canceled?
Yeah, well, that's what our friend Frank Jania tweeted about on a couple days ago. There is a website out there, as you might expect, called Is It Canceled Yet? And if you go to that website, you can see all kinds of things that have an answer of yes or no or maybe not. And it's a little bit funny and it's a little bit serious because it goes through a whole range of what's up and what isn't. So
yeah,
check it out. That's kind of good fun here. Now, another piece of the puzzle that's all related and to what's happening, all the cancellations, what's being tracked and changed around all this for COVID-19, is an interesting element around what scientists are doing to track the various strains of coronavirus and to understand when and where they came from, and understanding too to help notice when there are unique examples of a strain within a community, or if there are multiple strains, because that can help with the social network analysis that needs to happen and determining who may have been exposed to it by the genetic material involved in there. And from the article here, there's apparently over 150 different elements, because the virus mutates as they want to do. And all of this is being shared online in real time. And Michael, you know, I'm kind of reminded about, we've had a number of large scale disasters where communities of people quickly organize around the challenge, whether it's trying to find a missing plane in the middle of the ocean or, you know, or this, that there are ways to analyze and share data and do it in a common way and get to the breakthroughs that the world is needing faster.
Yeah. So. Well, then what's really interesting, I mean, as a virus, right, it mutates by default, right? It's trying to do the most effective way of reproducing. And so looking at the strains, understanding the variants, make a lot of sense. It's interesting when there are discoveries of what they call the community infections, and then looking at those in order to figure out what the genealogy of that infection is, right?
Yep.
Does it match to one of the known, quote unquote, the quotes around known, regular infections, right? One of the ones that came from a specific hotspot, et cetera. So the only thing that we know right now is there will be more. At least, again, I can only talk about the U.S. The U.S. is just now starting to do a lot of testing or starting to do testing. So every number that we have to date is too small, right? It's going to go up, and it's probably going to go up significantly just as we start testing. Matter of fact, my healthcare provider sent an email today indicating that they are now able to do testing. And,
you know,
it's, you know, X dollars. So the people who can afford it can be tested to just literally walk in and get a test done. So
interesting. Well, yeah. That's kind of cool. And I'm taking a look at the nextstrain.org environment and the visualization. So again, we're all about visualization here. And you're right, Michael, what we're seeing is where are the examples in the U.S. and then by the genetic signature, how do they root back, you know, across time? Where do they stem from?
Yeah. Yeah.
So cool. Very, very cool stuff. Have a look at this. If you like this, the example from Johns Hopkins, you're going to love this. All right. Moving along, that brings us to our next topic, which is kind of related and just, you know, watch, you'll see how it is. it's a little bit of a sad news story, at least for me, and that is that SETI at Home is on the verge of being discontinued. Michael, in the pre-show, you were telling me how you've been a SETI at Home contributor for at least a decade, right? So let's share with the listening audience, if they're not familiar, what it is and what your experience has been.
Yeah, I said I did it for about a decade. I actually started doing it back in 96 or 97.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
and I finally gave up when they switched from their own personal client to the Boinks client, just because I found the Boinks client a little awkward and annoying. But I've always found the SETI at Home process and the program to be just fantastic. It's a great way of, you know, leveraging the power of the crowd to process just a ton of data. And while the likelihood of any individual person solving the question of getting a radio or a light signal from another planet is infinitesimally small, because it's only pieces of the sky and you're doing one tiny piece of that data, I think the power that it put together and became kind of the foundation for many of these crowd knowledge searches, right? Whether it was folding at home, the various cancer treatments, other analysis. I thought this was just a brilliant idea. I guess I started it in 99. Right when it officially launched, so not 97, 98. But this, I find this so cool, and I find this very, very sad if they shut it down. But I can understand, you know, it's a lot of work to keep it going, right?
It is. And just for context, for those of you who are not from this planet and hadn't heard of it before, you know, tongue in cheek there, sorry. It's the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. It is a grid So computing solution where your machine, your computer, you would download packets of work and then analyze what these radio telescopes who had been watching, listening to the sky to try to determine if there were patterns out there that require further investigation. And from what I've read about this, and I don't pretend to know all of it, there's tons and tons of data that have been analyzed in that fashion that need now like a second or third look, I guess is what it's turning into. So it's been a cool way of being a citizen scientist and contributing most of the time unused computing cycles to something that was bigger than your own individual computer. And didn't they start this also with, they had like an Android client and a client that would run like on your PlayStation and a bunch of different places?
Well, it originally started as a Windows screensaver.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Back in 99. Android didn't exist in 99.
Well, but over time,
they developed unique clients for all kinds of machines, right? I mean, back in 2006, 2007, we were showing, you know, ray tracing using networked PS3s, which is kind of like a mini grid, if you want to call it, of a couple of PS3s in order to do some really cool stuff. But you could throw SETI at home at that, and just the compute power would be phenomenal for it, right? The challenge was you had to optimize the SETI algorithms to take advantage of the hardware. When they went to the Boinks client, they kind of simplified that, which made it much easier to get it available on many, many more devices, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that ubiquity, I guess, you know, of having unused cycles across a variety of devices would increase then, of course, the computing power for what you could do.
Exactly.
And today I'm on the Boink client myself. I'm contributing some of my unused cycles to the CERN superconducting super collider research. I'm contributing to a variety of World Community Grid stuff, where I've been also for, you know, eons. I have to go back and look and see when I started that, but it's been a long time too. And, you know, a funny thing, just linking this back to the whole COVID-19, there are grid computing capabilities on Folded and one or two other places, I think, right now that are applying the same kind of grid computing investigations to help determine what can be effective in slowing down the virus and causing it to not replicate as fast, because you can attach something to the proteins around it and so on. So I have to look for that too. And we'll put that in the show notes if that's something you feel like you'd like to contribute to. You'll be able to jump right in on that. Moving from a little more the esoteric way of using grid and grid computing on your existing hardware, you found a Science Daily article dealing with the IoT space and solar cells that happen to be indoor versus outdoor. So that's really, really intriguing. What's the story here?
For the longest time, I actually used a solar powered keyboard on a couple of my desktops here at the house, and they literally used the light from the lights in my office to power the solar panels. Right.
Yeah.
So the concept isn't that new, but what this is really doing is leveraging the increased capability and efficiency of solar sensors to get enough charge to charge IoT devices. So you'd be able to, you know, put this on something in order to deal with the different light spectrum that comes off of indoor lighting,
right?
And use that as a means of fueling, quote unquote, the devices. I think this is great, especially as we have more and more devices and we want to reduce the amount of clutter, i.e. wires going everywhere, but we want to make them more and more capable with more and more technology built in. Well, they need power. And, you know, there are multiple options. One, we can just irradiate them with power, power over the air. Or we could leverage the natural, quote unquote, power source of light, whether that's, you know, natural light from outside or man-made light from, you know, lights and other sources inside the home or the office. So I think this is a great way of getting IoT devices to have power over time and not have to worry about, you know, constantly changing batteries or finding a wiring place where you can actually plug them in.
I didn't get a chance to look at this article before we started getting ready here, but boy, how intriguing is this? 34% of visible light into electricity.
Yeah, that's pretty high. Like I said,
it's super high.
It's efficiencies that have gone up significantly that make solar power more powerful.
Yeah.
Or in this case, light power. Photovoltaic power.
Yep. And and using artificial intelligence and machine learning, you can reduce energy consumption because you're like, I don't
so,
need
so,
to be
so you doing that. Increase the input capacity.
Yep.
And you decrease the consumption, thereby extending the life overall.
Oh, it's just super cool.
Yeah.
What if, though, what if, Michael, I wanted to decrease my consumption of trackers that are tracking me on the web? How would I do that?
Well, you could do like I do and just have a pie hole in the house. But DuckDuckGo just announced a new project that they are doing that they call, what is it, DuckDuckGo's Tracker Radar. DuckDuckGo is interesting because they are a website that does search engines that does not use tracking information in order to present you with ads. Now, people can buy ads on DuckDuckGo and they'll display ads based off of what you search for, not your entire life history of ever being on the web. And as they've been using their privacy tools over time, they've been able to identify more and more sites that have tracking information. And so they use this now to continue to reduce tracking from sites that you go to based off of their search engines. And they've now made this available to others as, you know, as an ability to build a tracker distractor and reduce the amount of tracking that happens from other sites. So there's a couple of browsers that are starting to use this and embed this tracker radar in them in order to reduce tracking. I'm betting that it will not be long before the pie hole people will actually use this as one of the input feeds for locking, you know, locking down some of the trackers. And it's I think it's fantastic. And the ability to, again, kind of reestablish, if it ever was truly there, a level of privacy on your behavior online is important from a privacy and security perspective.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, I'm a big DuckDuckGo fan, and it's cool to see that they've got new stuff like this here too.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we are getting close to being done with our show for today. So we had two more things that hit quickly. The first was a fun little article about someone who entered a contest and won, quote unquote, the contest to not have a smartphone for a year. And by winning that contest and starting the year to not have a smartphone, this particular person could win $100,000. And so maybe just the fast question for you, Michael, is if you had to put down your phone and have just a flip phone that would do phone calls and nothing more for a year for $100,000, would you be willing to do it?
Yeah, be easy to do.
Yeah, I would be on that too. $100,000 Well, absolutely.
And I can tell you in our household that we're already doing that with at least 50% of us.
Oh, well, there you are. All right. So last, you're a big Kids in the Hall fan, aren't
you? Yes. Back in the day, it was kind of a three-way toss-up between, and I know these are all in slightly different timelines, but between Fridays, which was a show, Saturday Night Live, and the Kids in the Hall, sketch comedy at its finest.
Yep, Canadian sketch comedy.
Oh, SCTV, right? That was,
yes.
SCTV and Kids in the Hall were the two premier Canadian sketch comedy shows, and Amazon. Yep, I found this. This is making me excited. They've just announced a deal. The Kids in the Hall team is working with Amazon to put out 8 new episodes. 30 years later, can't believe I can say that. And I am so looking forward to this.
Lorne Michaels is involved in it.
Oh,
you know.
Yep.
There you go.
I'm ecstatic. Can't wait. And we'll have to give a review when they come out.
Yeah. And crush their heads.
Yes. Nobody's home.
Okay.
Nobody's home.
All right. Well, we hope you've enjoyed this week's show and all the cancellations that have happened. And hopefully things that you want to do aren't canceled, and you will be able to come back here and hear the next edition of GamesAtWork.biz. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
See ya.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz or at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.